Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's Glassnode's proxy talk. We'll be discussing climate change risk shareholder proposals. Want to let everyone know that the lines have been placed on a listen-only mode for this call. If you want to ask questions of the participant, please enter them in the question box in the lower right part of your screen. And just before we kick things off, I just want to remind everyone that this conference call and our conference call series should not be considered a solicitation of proxies by Glass-Lewis itself. Glass-Lewis has not sought permission to do so from the SEC, nor will it. This call is for information purposes only and should not be construed as providing investment advice. In addition, Glass-Lewis makes no representation regarding the accuracy, completeness, or reliability of any statement, information, opinion, or view presented by its guest speakers. We are recording this call and it will be available on the Glass-Lewis website following the call, so if you missed part of it, you can always go back and listen to it. So at this point, I just want to provide a brief background. Over the last couple of years, there's been much more attention focused on environmental issues, and particularly coming out of the Paris Accords, there's even heightened attention, I would say. So today, we'll be talking about some of the shareholder initiatives, mainly through shareholder proposals, but also through engagement relating to environmental issues that shareholders have focused on, in particular shareholder proposals that we'll see at companies in 2016, including proposals requesting disclosure on climate change risk and opportunities. Some of our proposals, sometimes called Aiming for A, received well of majority support at a handful of European companies last year where they were submitted, due in large part to the fact that in these cases the companies were themselves recommended shareholders vote in favor. So I'm going to be joined on the call by Ann Simpson, who's the Investment Director of Global Governance at CalPERS, Mike Garland, who's Assistant Comptroller for Corporate Governance and Responsible Investment in the Office of New York City Comptroller Scott Stringer, and Helen Wildsmith, who's a Stewardship Director, Climate Change at CCLA. And I'm also joined by my colleague, Courtney Keating, who's the Director of ESG Research here at Glass-Lewis. So the format, we're going to start with discussing some of the proposals and the background behind those, and Anne's going to kick that off. And then Mike is going to talk about some of the tie-in with proxy access and how that, looking at the role of the board in evaluating these issues. And then we're going to hear from Helen and hear about, you know, how these initiatives have been working at companies, particularly in Europe, that have embraced some of these initiatives. Again, if you have questions, please submit them via the text box in the lower right-hand part of the screen. At this point, I want to turn it over to Anne to kick things off. You know, these are proposals that CalPERS has many cases supported and in some cases submitted itself. So maybe you can give some background on sort of the reason behind these proposals and ultimately, you know, how investors benefit from some of these steps that you're asking companies to take.
Thanks very much, Bob, and good morning to everyone who's dialed in or listening through computer or phone. I'd like to set the scene by explaining where climate risk and opportunity is viewed in the CalPERS investment strategy. 2 years ago, the board at CalPERS adopted a set of 10 investment beliefs. And this really came out of us reflecting long and hard on how to achieve sustainable returns over a very long period, and thinking about markets, thinking about companies, and wondering where sustainability factors like environmental risk or issues around human capital really fitted in into the risk and return agenda. And we expressed two views. One is that the policy framework in financial markets is really critical to long-term sustainable value creation. And we all know that after the financial crisis, we were working hard with many of you on Dodd-Frank or European and Asian reforms. But we've also, out of that, came to realize that on the issues of climate change, the policy framework there was going to be vitally important to markets working properly. So I'm glad to say with the leadership of Ceres, where our chief executive, Anne Stalsbol, is chair of the board, Ceres rounded up a group of investors through an initiative called the Investor Network on Climate Risk. And we developed, I think, a very powerful statement in the run-up to the Paris Agreement, which came out in December. And that was really looking at the importance of having a policy framework for dealing with the market's problem or difficulty in addressing risks and opportunities. So a strong message was sent that we need carbon pricing. Another was that we wanted to see removal of subsidies for fossil fuels. And several of the major funds involved were actually at the negotiations in Paris. And I was delighted to be there for CalPERS with others. So what came out of Paris, we see as a game changer in framing what the market will need to respond to over the next 30 years. So the first thing we'd highlight in this agreement and why it's a whole new chapter in investment around climate change, first of all, the global scope of the agreement. There are close to 200 countries that presented their plans for reducing climate change greenhouse gas emissions. Secondly, it's important that the business community showed up in force to support this. Over 5,000 companies issued statements supporting the agreement. And the investor network that was represented had assets under management over $20 trillion. And I think this was recognized by the governments as a very powerful combination. And I know that on very late night, no doubt over some fine French wine, the negotiations were getting very tough on the second draft of the agreement, and we received a phone call from the secretariat in Paris to say, look, there's a wobble. There's some pieces here that the government representatives think are too tough. We need to hear from investors. And CalPERS and many other investors sent late night messages whilst the second round of negotiations were going on, really to say, hold the line, we need a tough deal, because if we don't get this policy framework, we can't make long-term investment decisions, and companies can't plan either. So the good news is the second draft that was agreed sets us on a path from Paris to increasing global temperatures to just under 3 degrees. Centigrade. Now, why does that matter? It matters because 3 degrees is the point at which polar ice caps are expected to melt. And that will be a very visible sign of failure because of the massive sea level rise that will bring and changes to global warming and cooling. And of course, along the way, we know there are a lot of other risks attached to climate change with water, with drought, water inundation, food impact on food supplies, ultimately migration and so forth. So the importance of holding the global warming to 2 degrees or less is really the overall ambition of the Paris Agreement. We can talk a bit more about whether we think it will stick in the questions. The second piece that came out in Paris that we think is vitally important is that the world's central banks have recognized that climate change may pose a risk to financial markets. And the G20, which is the largest 20 economies represented by their government finance ministers, asked the Financial Stability Board, which is where the central bankers hang out worrying about these issues, to explore this issue and to look at the question of disclosure. And Mark Carney, who's the chair of that and currently the governor of the Bank of England, said, you know, there is a tragedy of horizon. In other words, markets do a good job pricing, and I suppose we see that in the short term and we see a lot of volatility around that. But over the long term, the tragedy of the horizon is that some of these risks will crystallize and bring irreversible damage, and we need to be in a preventative mode. If you're a long-term owner, like a pension fund, as we are. So the three areas the Financial Services Board is looking at is, first of all, physical risk. What sort of resilience in assets, what sort of management. Think about companies having refineries or buildings on coastal areas and what's happening with changes in sea level rises, for example. The second area of risk that they highlighted is transition risk. Now, this is where you can see some ugly results as the market price-driven reprices what's going on. And I think the very painful transition for coal from a financial point of view, never mind for the communities that are affected and the workforce, is a current example of that. And thirdly, Mike Carney and the remit for this study group highlighted liability risk. And this is where both particularly for the insurance industry, but also the question of who will come calling for reimbursement, recompense, restitution, if we find damage where previously none was predicted. In other words, the failure of proper risk management. So what this said to us at CalPERS is this has really moved from being an environmental issue into a mainstream investment issue. So that set the stage for us saying, okay, we've got this policy framework. If all goes well and we, you know, have our shoulders to the wheel collectively, we'll get to just under a 3 degrees. But we know from our own portfolio, because we've completed what's called a carbon footprint, that some 80 companies are responsible for 50% of the emissions that are contributing to global warming. So we feel that the global investor community can really link arms and address the long-term risks and opportunities with companies that need to make the transition. So what's missing? Well, at the moment, we don't have disclosure that will enable us to, from an investment perspective, understand whether companies have looked at the scenarios within this new global plan and communicated to investors what they're doing. I think an early example that we think does a pretty good job is BHP Billiton, snarled up with other problems in Brazil and failures, but they have produced three scenarios within the 2 degrees increase in temperature that's considered allows viable economic growth for the long term. So we're seeing examples. So we decided this year that we would do more than just vote in favor of risk reporting proposals, but that we would step up CalPERS support by building on a project called the Carbon Asset Review, which Ceres has led. It's enabled us to write, meet, talk with the major energy companies about their plans. But where we've not had a constructive, illuminating response from the companies, we decided that where Ceres members have filed proposals calling for risk reporting around the new Paris agenda, that CalPERS needed to do more than just vote in favor. So we are going to be running proxy solicitations for those group of proposals, and we can talk about the individual companies, and also engaging with the SEC, where companies are seeking to have these type of proposals excluded from the ballot. And I think the most recent example there is Exxon, where our fellow investors in the New York State Pension Fund filed at Exxon on this issue. And last year, you'll recall, Exxon was given permission by the SEC to remove a similar proposal, so we didn't have an opportunity to vote at Exxon. Although I'm glad to say through the good work of New York, there was a proxy access proposal to vote on. This time, the SEC agreed that Exxon should not be allowed to exclude. So I think this is a sign that regulators understand investors need an opportunity to speak on these issues. So I think just to wrap up on the CalPERS approach, we see this as an issue which is underpinned by our fiduciary duty to be prudent, to act with loyalty and care. And if companies do not provide us with the risk reporting, we as good fiduciaries are not in a position to understand how this transition is going to affect the management and mitigation of risk over the long term. So I think this is a very critical part of this season's proxy season, particularly in the US. And apart from working closely with the board accountability project that New York City leads, I'm delighted to say we've also this year co-filed at the companies where Helen Wildsmith team has been filing, and she obviously, Helen will speak more about that in a moment. So this is a critical issue for risk and return. We can't just rely on government to drive this agenda. as the owners of companies, we have not only, I think, the right, but also the responsibility to ensure that this long-term agenda moves forwards in a constructive way. So the votes will set the stage, for, I think, for a greatly improved dialogue with companies. And just to finally say, the other thing that CalPERS has done, some of you will have seen, is we've had a big review of our global governance principles that frame our engagement and advocacy and integration work. And we've highlighted the need for boards to have skills and experience on climate change risk so that they're able to address these issues. So we've actually started to think about the need for board competence, not just independence, not just diversity, two important themes for us as owners, but also to understand that competence on climate change and both risks and opportunities is something we need to start tracking on board evaluation. So thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Well, that's a perfect segue to Mike in terms of the role of proxy access, maybe where there isn't that board experience, capability, skills, and competence. So Mike, maybe you could comment on how proxy access dovetails with climate risk.
Sure. Thank you, Bob, and thanks for hosting the call. And Anne, thank you for that not only nice setup, but nice transition for what I wanted to talk about. So for New York City, as long-term investors and like CalPERS and others, we believe that climate change creates risks across our portfolio. But at this point, those risks are not well understood. They're difficult to price, and I think that is why we're all focused on disclosure. And we do sense that while it's across the portfolio, the risks are particularly acute for businesses that extract or burn carbon, and especially in light of the commitments that came out of the Paris Agreement that Anne referenced. And so I do want to go a little deeper on board oversight. But before I do, I do want to just signal that New York City is also supportive of the 2-degree resolutions that have been filed at the, I think it's 8 or so, U.S. energy companies, and intends to vote in support of those resolutions. We think that the disclosure requests there are important to allow us to assess risk. Certainly the response among the US companies and the difference, the divide between the responses in the US and non-US is something we've noted. And I do think it speaks to the board quality, composition, and responsiveness. Wanted to make note of the study that came out of Oxford last year that looked at the diversity of boards, the major oil and gas companies in the world, the 10 largest, diversity across several dimensions. I think nationality, gender, tenure, industry experience, and interestingly, the three U.S. companies in the mix, Exxon, Chevron, and ConocoPhillips, and with the first two of those in particular highlighted, had the least diverse boards. And I don't know if that's one of the factors that's driving the divide, but it's certainly something that we think about as we think about the composition of the boards in the energy industry. And certainly as we move forward, disclosure is critical, but ultimately we need the board to be focused on how capital allocation, business strategy, how the board is managing risks over the long term. Climate risk has to be among those, and we need directors in the boardroom who have the expertise to understand the regulatory implications, the physical impacts, and what we're talking about isn't necessarily an individual director with a particular expertise, but that the board as a whole needs to have the right competence, a climate competent board. And in order to, I think, empower shareholders to engage more meaningfully around board quality and composition, we decided when we launched our Boardroom Accountability Project in the fall of 2014, in which we did 75 proxy access proposals. Those proposals were focused on three baskets of companies that we thought presented particular risks. One was companies that lacked adequate diversity in the boardroom. Another was companies with excessive compensation. And the third, and the basket which included the most companies, were the carbon-intensive energy companies. When we had submitted proposals to 33 of the most carbon-intensive energy companies in the U.S., seeking the right to, for 3% shareholders to nominate up to a quarter of the board. Today, 27 of those 33 companies have enacted or agreed to enact a viable proxy access bylaw, meaning it for 3% owners. You know, only four of our initial focus lists did we need to go back to this year where there'll be a vote. Two of them also have two-degree resolutions. That's Exxon and Noble. And Exxon's really an outlier in the sense that every other major oil and gas company, and frankly, most major companies in the U.S. have now enacted proxy access. There was a 49.4% vote on the proposal last year. We hope to push that over a majority this year. But I would emphasize that many of the companies that got less than majority votes last year have since enacted proxy access. And for the seven additional energy companies that we focused on this year, we've already withdrawn five of those proposals. So the landscape has really shifted, and companies are responding. And we haven't had to go to a vote in most cases. Of the two proposals for new companies going to a vote, one is NRG, and management is neutral on the proposal. And the other is WC Energy Corp. So, you know, we think proxy access is a fundamental right. We want it at all our portfolio companies, but certainly it is a piece of the foundation that I think will allow investors to engage boards more deeply on the composition of the board. And I think, you know, as we think about the evolution of governance over the past 10 or 15 years, you know, we've focused on independence and accountability, but as Ann mentioned, I think we're moving toward really board quality. Not only do we want directors who are independent and qualified, but that they're qualified for that board and they make sense on that board, and that they bring a diverse set of experiences, perspectives, and expertise. Why don't I leave it at that and turn it back to you, Bob.
Great. Thanks, Mike. I don't know if you just coined that term, but climate competent sounds like a great way to characterize directors with that level of expertise. Now I'd like to hear from Helen. I think you know, we've got a good background on what's going on in the U.S. You know, on some issues, the Europeans are ahead of the U.S. Certainly proxy access and Sam Hay and independent chairman are issues like that, but obviously climate risk reporting seems to be one of those, particularly given that at least a handful of companies themselves have supported proposals submitted by shareholders regarding climate risk reporting. But Helen, maybe before you start off in describing, you know, how it's worked and how responsible the companies have been, maybe you can just describe a little bit of what CCLA is for our clients who may not be aware of that.
Yes, no, of course, and thank you very much for inviting me onto the call, and I must say it's very exciting to be working internationally on these issues these days. CCLA stands for Churches, Charities and Local Authorities. We're a UK mutual working with those sorts of UK-based clients across their global portfolios. And I think outside the UK borders, we're probably best known for the Aiming for A initiative, which I brought together back in 2011. And we were very much thinking along the lines that Anne was talking about, that climate change is a systemic risk, that we had a fiduciary duty to step forward and do something about it. And we felt that one really important element in addressing this collective action problem, the tragedy of the horizons, as Mark Carney has called it, is that we really needed to amplify the voice of the long-term investor. And we were hearing from the companies that we were engaging with that they couldn't really do anything to move forward on the low carbon transition, not only because there wasn't a good policy framework, but also they were getting a lot of messages from shorter term investors that the here and now was more important than addressing these longer term risks and opportunities. And it occurred to us that shareholder resolutions could probably play a very positive stewardship role in this process if we could get to the point where the boards of the companies would agree to proposals that indicated that their long-term investors were wanting to work with them through what will be a multi-decade transition through to a low-carbon economy. And all our resolutions so far have been called Strategic Resilience for 2035 and Beyond, and have covered five key things, the most important of which have been about portfolio resilience against different future scenarios, including 2-degree scenarios, but also how companies are working with policymakers so that we're trying to break that collective action problem and getting companies, policymakers and investors working together to move things forward. And some of the stories that Anne was talking about coming out of Paris indicate that part of the reason we did get an agreement was because people from the different sectors were prepared to work together to move things forward. And so we had the resolutions last year at BP and Shell, where we got board support for both of them, and really applaud both those companies' leadership in doing that. And we got over 98% of the vote. The AP funds in Sweden managed to co-file at Statoil last year and also got over 98% with board support. We're delighted actually that Total, the French oil and gas company this year, has actually agreed at board level themselves to essentially hold themselves to the shareholder resolutions that have been passed at BP, Shell and Statoil. And it sort of gives you an indication that there is a ripple effect from those votes last year. And of course this year we've co-filed at Rio Tinto, Anglo American and Glencore, and as Anne mentioned, BHP Billiton preempted a shareholder resolution by producing a report last year on the back of our engagement. And again, we've got the board support, and those AGMs are starting very shortly, and we hope that those resolutions will be carried. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, two of the ways in which people are working collectively over here, one of which is the Oil and Gas Climate Initiative, where we're seeing the oil and gas majors coming together to work on a number of things that where they can move forward more easily together than individually, and where they can work with policymakers to move things forward, whether that's carbon pricing or some of the more nitty-gritty areas of policy making. And the Oil and Gas Climate Initiative is CEO-led and now covers, I think it's about 20% of the oil and gas sector globally. And we would love to see that become a transatlantic initiative. The other thing that we did over here that was sort of stunningly more successful than we really expected it to be was that the Aiming for A coalition is actually 230 billion of investors, just nine of us, the CCLA, the Local Authority Pension Fund Forum, the largest members of the Church Investors Group, Hermes, the Pensions Trust, and two of the wealth managers over here, Saracen and Rathbones. But we wanted to make sure that all the players in Europe could get involved in the AGM process. So we set up a process where people could declare in advance of AGMs their votes. And this really helped with that amplification of the voice of the long-term investor. So we're doing that again for the mining companies this year. And I'm delighted to say that INCR, who as Anne said coordinate the Carbon Asset Risk Initiative, are going to be doing that for 9 of the 2-degree resolutions this year, and a number of European investors, including some very major ones, have already stepped up and said they're going to declare their votes through that. And I think it's just essential that the boards hear from as many long-term investors as possible that we do support them through this long, complex, low-carbon transition that we all face. As we all know, a transition that's well managed is going to be much better for all our portfolios than one that isn't well managed, that creates draconian policies that have to be brought in at the last minute. And that will not be good for the economies or our portfolios. But I think I'll leave it there for now.
Okay. Actually, I just have one follow-up question specifically. So you mentioned the Oil and Gas Climate Initiative, and that sounds a really fascinating group. You mentioned that you welcome a more transatlantic, participation. Is it mainly just U.S. EU companies who represent that 20% of global production or industry, or are there any North American?
There are no North American companies. All the listed companies within it are European oil and gas majors. There are some of the national oil companies from other regions involved, but it would be fantastic to see some of the US oil and gas majors getting involved in that initiative. It's CEO-led, and I was delighted to be invited to their report launch event in Paris last October, and they really are doing some very meaningful things and interacting with very senior people at the World Bank and other organizations who we also know need to be moving things forward to help the low carbon transition.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, this is Courtney. Thank you all so much for being on this call. This has been really, really helpful for us. And I have a couple questions. First, I was wondering if you could talk about the current level of disclosure at the companies that you're targeting with the proposal in the U.S., specifically Exxon, who produced, I know, a report on carbon asset risk a number of years ago, and maybe discuss why the current disclosure is insufficient.
Hello, this is Anne. I think there's a common theme with companies on reporting, which is that it lacks the recognition of this new framework. I think, you know, Exxon's position has been that we don't see the likelihood or the credible option of a government agreement to address climate change. So therefore, there isn't a risk on which to report. You know, in other areas, Exxon has moved its position. For example, they now support the idea of carbon pricing, which is very good. But of course, that was then, and this is now. We have a global agreement, it has very specific targets. Under some calculations, more than half of the declared proven reserves in the listed company sectors globally will not be able to be burned and meet the target that's been set. So that poses a conundrum. Will it be that a handful of companies continue to keep the full financial credit on the balance sheet for the reserves that they have? Or how do companies in a sector, and for us as a portfolio, because we own a piece of all of these companies, how does the carbon budget, which is implied by this 2 degrees target, how does that actually affect long-term plans? So I don't think it's any more credible now for for any company to say there will not be an intergovernmental plan, because the facts have changed. We have a plan. And so now what we need to know is that companies have scenarios which actually test their asset resilience, their strategy, the mitigation within that goal. So I suppose, you know, I think some of the companies are in still in a sort of King Canute, sitting, calling on the waves to retreat. It's not that, you know, this tide has turned, and the level of reporting that we're getting is simply, you know, not rigorous. It's not comparable. We are looking to this Financial Stability Board framework to give us better guidance, but it's not, it's simply not got the rigor, and it's not set within this new Paris Agreement. So I think, you know, there's a step change needed in risk reporting. And unfortunately, there's, you know, we've had for a long time, and, you know, credit to Ceres, because they organized a group of investors to go to the SEC and say, look, risk is meant to be part of 10K reporting. However, you know, thank you, the SEC confirmed that climate change was one of the risks that should be addressed, but we've seen very little improvement in either the scope or the depth or quality of reporting. And just as an example of what it might look like, CalPERS is a supporter of the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, and they have developed an approach looking at taking the important notion of materiality and looking at climate change sector by sector, and have assessed, you know, a dozen or so very important areas of potential risk. And this is on a level that could be integrated into the financial reports, which is what we ultimately want. We don't want improvised, you know, hobbyist approaches running alongside the financials. We want this all integrated ultimately. So I think, you know, the there are companies responding in their in management statements to the proxy proposals, the sharing of proposals that we have on the books, and that's good, because it's, you know, companies are stepping up and say, look, we do this, look, we do that. But it is a very long way from a robust explanation of scenarios within the Paris Agreement. And it's certainly not at a level where you can compare across a sector, and it's certainly not at a level that will allow integration into the financials. But I think the dialogue has begun, for sure.
And Courtney, it's Mike. I just a brief additional comment, and I share the CalPERS perspective. But with respect to Exxon, I think it's important to recognize that though they continue to assert that they don't need to, that they're already complying with the disclosure, and they did that when we spoke to them, and they did that in their no action request. The SEC rejected that argument, and that's why we fortunately have the opportunity and responsibility to vote on the proposal at the meeting.
Absolutely, thank you. Do you guys have any good examples of companies that have provided the disclosure that you're asking for, or that are kind of on the way to providing that disclosure?
Yes, I think BHP Billiton's been mentioned before by me and by Helen. And I think that's a very interesting company, because you'll recall there was a dissident candidate, Ian Dunlop, who ran for the board. I think CalPERS was one of the few investors the first time round to support that as a candidate. And he was really challenging the board on its ability to grapple with the risks that were ahead. And I think this was really laying the early groundwork for this idea that you need a climate-competent board, as we were just saying. And I think through the good engagement with CCLA and also the US funds, the chairman actually came to see us here in California and they've appointed a climate scientist to advise the board. There are a whole series of quite important changes there. So the report that they've come up with, which as Helen said, has sort of preempted the need for a proposal, is a very good model, because what they've done is say, It's very readable. It's not, you know, it doesn't run to thousands of pages which have been lawyered up to the ceiling, so it's hard to get any sense of what's really going on. There's very specific, okay, here are the three scenarios the board has looked at. We think there are three possible paths for the company to follow. All of those three are within the framework of the 2 degrees scenario. Now, this was published just before the Paris Agreement, so I think BHP's got the jump. But what we're looking forward to is seeing how the Aiming for A proposals at BP, Shell, and Statoil are going to generate new reporting, and Total, as Helen said. So maybe, Helen, you could comment on what you're seeing that's coming through following those proposals, or is it too early?
It's too early for some, but we are starting to see year one reporting completed for some of the companies, and of course it's BP's AGM next week, and I lead the engagement on BP, so perhaps I should talk about them. Since we filed the resolution, in terms of reporting, they've published their internal technology outlook for the first time, and we'll be updating that on a regular basis, and if you haven't looked at it, I would recommend it. They also, within their energy outlook, a number of us working through IIGCC, which is the Institutional Investors Group on Climate Change here in Europe, the sister organisation to INCR, have been engaging with BP for some time to say, within your energy outlook, don't just present one case, but start to look at alternative futures so you can start to stress test your business against those. And in February this year, they published something that's called a faster transition. And the BP team worked very hard between Paris and the launch of their energy outlook to take the nationally determined contributions that people had been talking about in Paris and apply one ratchet, that phrase from the Paris Agreement, and then look to see what that would do to oil and gas demand. And if you have a look at that, you'll see that under their faster transition, oil demand actually peaks in the 2020s, and they're having some very interesting board discussions around that, as you can imagine. And I think it's particularly interesting at BP, not a reporting point, but an organisational change point, that their new deputy CEO role includes long-term strategic planning. And it'll be very interesting to see what we get from them in their strategy presentations next year. There are also things that we want BP to do more of. We could do with more quantification. Of course, we'd love to see that faster transition, which we're reassured is consistent with the IEA bridge scenario, tracked out through the whole period to get to the sort of net zero. So more to be done, but very good year one progress.
Thank you. So I have a couple of questions about the regulation surrounding emissions. First of all, do you think that the Supreme Court stay on the Clean Power Plan, do you think that has any effect on the United States' ability to enter into the Paris Accord? And do you think that it's made companies kind of view the legal and regulatory risks associated with reducing their emissions any greater?
Mike, do you want to comment on that?
Sure. Well, I mean, I make a couple comments. First of all, with respect to the utilities that are front and center, though a subset of them and states they're located in have challenged it, you know, my understanding is that the majority of the utility sector is already assuming that they will have to transition regardless, and there is a split within the industry, but I think it would be it wouldn't be wise risk management for a board to postpone taking action because of a legal challenge. I can tell you that as investors, we're supportive of the Clean Power Plan. We want stable incentives and a stable investment environment so that both companies and investors can make informed investment decisions. So I'm not sure if I'm responding directly to the question. Did I respond? Can you?
Yeah, I think, sorry, I'll just add to Mike on the story. I think some of you have noticed that there was the move to have the Clean Power Plan put on hold to allow a petition, you know, to allow these suits to go ahead. And then there was some, you know, speculation that because the Supreme Court is now hung, if you like, on the political spectrum of liberal versus conservative, which are very broad bucket terms, I know, for legal opinions and approaches. So that has, I think, meant that the track for litigation or for the suit, you know, it's thrown a spanner in the works. That's one thing. And I agree with Mike that we've got, so there was an interesting piece in the Washington Post about this, talking about the other pressures on the utilities which are leading them down this path from Paris. You know, part of it's being driven by the availability of alternatives to coal. You know, there's a bigger, hanging your business strategy on the hope for an outcome for preventing this Clean Power Act going ahead. It seems that this is cutting in an opposite direction to this international plan. And I think the other thing we were very mindful of is that, you know, last week, China and America, the United States, on the same day together, you know, made their announcement about their commitment to the Paris Agreement. So I think that this is, you know, the tide of the economy, the economic drivers is very strong, it's very powerful, and we view this as a spat in the legal system, and there's just excuse me, something that is a, you know, part of the next phase. I think we'd see this more as a pause along the way than something which is going to fundamentally undermine the United States commitment. There are too many economic drivers running with the Paris Agreement.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you. And Mike, I know you brought up the utility companies and you know, their exposure to these kinds of regulations. And you know, given that the vast majority of GHG regulations so far have really seemed to be targeted at utility companies, or you know, coal-fired generation more specifically, why are you choosing to target oil and gas companies with these 2-degree scenario proposals?
So, first of all, although we support them, you know, New York City isn't filing the 2-degree proposals. What we've done, and you know, we have a significant capacity to file proposals, and we've overwhelmingly deployed that on proxy access. And I will say that directly to your point, though, all of the new companies that so last proxy season we focused on oil and gas utilities and coal. There were 33 carbon-intensive energy companies. We added 7 new energy companies this year. All of them are utilities, and they tend to be more coal-intensive utilities. And separately, the few non-proxy access proposals we're filing include political disclosure proposals, which we've also focused on the energy industry, and mainly on all the new ones are utilities. So that we have, and I think both are informed by the notion that there is a split or a potential divide in the utility industry. And the theory of transition is most straightforward within that sector. If you're a utility, you know, if you're a coal company, you know, you have to think long and hard about how you're going to survive over the long term, but I think the prospects are pretty dim. If you're a utility company, you can make strategic choices about how you generate power, whether and how much you're investing in alternatives, what your carbon profile is, and whether you choose change your business strategy, or whether, you know, frankly, you funnel opaque money into the political system in order to try and block reform. So we are very much focused on that sector. I can't speak to why those companies did or didn't receive the two-degree proposals.
Yes, let me add a footnote to that. Ceres and members of Ceres, and I'm sure are on this call, Ceres initiated this very important engagement with 46 energy companies and utilities 3 years ago under this carbon asset risk initiative, which CalPERS was a strong supporter of. And the members of Ceres, who are very wide-ranging, there are over 100 investors who are, including CalPERS, of course, in New York City, are members and sit on the board. But there's a wide range of investors in the Ceres community who have been part of that engagement and have chosen to follow up filing these proposals because the engagement has not generated the result that we were looking for, which is this robust scenario-based risk reporting. So obviously the first step was to write to these companies, put a very thoughtful request explaining why we want this type of risk reporting around scenarios and giving an indication of the issues that need to be addressed. We don't want, you know, there isn't an all-purpose statement that will suit for all companies, but giving real, I think, texture, nuance to the request for the risk reporting. And you know, the next step is to say, okay, well, we've had the engagement, we've had the conversation, it hasn't taken us anywhere, so we now need to move from the talk to the action. And that's where the proposals have come from. And credit to the wide range of fellow investors who have filed, and they do include some co-filings with European investment management company Hermes is included, the Tri-State Coalition, New York State, and many others. So it has not just been a collection of names plucked out of the air. It has been a very strategic follow-through from the carbon asset risk review engagement that Ceres initiated.
And is there a list of the companies you're targeting if, you know, listeners are interested in making sure they don't miss those particular meetings?
Yes, I mean, obviously we have a list because we're doing the proxy solicitations, and also we have that. But I would like to ask the proponents who filed permission if the list was to be put forward. But I'm sure it would be very helpful if Glass Lewis and Glass Lewis's clients could have that list and just make sure they don't miss any opportunities in the votes that are coming up. But you'll be having solicitations from CalPERS, and I'm sure everybody will be reading the Glass Lewis analysis very carefully as well.
Okay, and it's Mike. I'll take responsibility if anyone gets in trouble. But I think all of the proposals are public, and in many cases the proxies are out. And I'd be happy to name the companies if that were helpful.
Maybe we could.
Yeah, the proxies are. I mean, Exxon's probably an example, but it's no surprise what's going on at Exxon because of the SEC. That's a good point.
Mindy, follow up, and we happen to host that. We'll enter a blog post regarding the call, and we can add those names to that.
Okay,
great.
You know, there's one company I did that I will fess up. I believe is on the list, but I wanted to flag for investors on the call because it's going to be a challenging vote, and that's First Energy. There are two companies where we had majority votes and the companies responded on proxy access, First Energy and Southern Company, that are energy companies that are incorporated in states that require shareholder approval for bylaw amendments. And in the case of First Energy, the management is putting forward a responsive bylaw, and we're very supportive of what management's doing. That proposal is going to pass, it's going to require 80% of outstanding shares. So while we expect that, given management's recommendation, that the overwhelming number of voting investors will support the proposal, we are concerned about turnout. So I want to highlight that so that make sure everyone is focused and does cast a vote on that proposal.
Okay. Thanks, Mike.
And I just wanted to flag another company as well. In Canada, Suncor has got a resolution this year which has got board support. That's been filed by NEI Investments, and they're encouraging investors to write to the board to thank the board for supporting that resolution and indicating that they are part of the group of investors who are prepared to work with the company through the low carbon transition.
Thanks for that. Okay,
excellent.
Mike, thanks for that.
Yeah. Series community, and also we can ask Series with their members. Several of the proposals that were initially filed have been withdrawn. And I think this is very encouraging because, as you know, we're all aware the shareholder rights regimes in different countries are very different, and Europeans have much stronger shareholder rights, so the engagement can be more powerful and effective. And but in the US, where the shareholder rights regime is weaker, engagement has really only, I think, in recent years just started to really gain momentum. So, but several companies have got to the point of agreement with the proponents that there has been withdrawal. And I think that's a very positive sign to sort of build out the community of companies who want to work with shareholders on this issue and not be in conflict, you know, and say this is actually a shared agenda. Good, robust, long-term risk reporting on climate change is something that's going to be useful for the company because it's going to allow them to communicate their long-term goals with the owners and I think help them ride some of the turbulence in the transition in the financial markets. And we've certainly seen how that's hit some companies quite hard.
Right. Well, thanks. Well, we're coming up to the end, and we did get one question. Maybe I can frame it more broadly and ask you each brief comment and then add any final comments. It was basically about, you know, are you looking for any additional coal filers on the proposals? I understand on the, Helen, you indicated that your proposals have already been basically acted upon, but in the U.S., are there a need for coal filers, and maybe a broader question is, you know, if Shirley's on this call, if they're part of the that large group of long-term investors, apart from supporting the proposals, what else could they do to support these initiatives? Maybe Anne, I could pose that initially to you. Are you looking for coal filers?
We're not looking for coal filers, which is a timing issue. These proposals have typically been filed at the end of last year. In advance, actually, of the Paris Agreement, so all credit to the proponents. We then walked out of the Paris Agreement with a real deal on the table, which is terrific. But I think that it might be in other markets that the cycle, the timetable is different. What we're looking for, we hope here, is Ceres has opened up, as Helen mentioned, an opportunity through INCR for shareholders to say in advance what they're planning to do, which is to support the proposals. And we hope that that gives a new opportunity for the companies to say, well, this is actually important to many in our investor base. So perhaps companies might have a change of heart and think, you know, this is something we should work with rather than against. And I think that would be really very encouraging. I know some companies have already gone to press with their proxy statements, and they have a rather the answer is no, because it's a share and a proposal, we won't support this. But I hope we can get past that, and we can get to some, you know, shared commitment to get this right.
Thanks. Any last thoughts from you, Mike?
No, I appreciate you hosted the call and encourage investors to look at these votes. I think I agree with Anne, it's important to send a message because I think what we've seen certainly in the U.S. is boards have been less responsive on disclosure and have review the proposals hostily, and the only way I think to move them is to send a message with voting support.
Gotcha. And Helen, I know it's getting late for you in the UK, but maybe I'll give you the last word if there's any comments or tips for our for shareholders who may not have who may not be as in environments where the discussions are less hostile.
I think you have to have a great deal of patience to work on these sort of multi-decade initiatives, and I think the more we can all work together, we can be more powerful in amplifying that voice of the long-term investor. And I really would like to thank CalPERS and the other state funds and the US Methodists and other members of ICCR, INCR for working so closely with us through our journey. And as I said at the beginning, it's fantastic that we're all increasingly working together on this.
All right, well, great. Well, I want to thank Anne, Mike, and Helen for joining us on the call, and my colleague Courtney here, and everyone who joined us on the call. We're just a little bit over, so I'll sign off now, but I really want to thank everyone for joining. If you have any further questions or comments, feel free to email us at proxytalk@glassluis.com. But this does conclude today's call. Thanks again, everyone who joined, and I wish everyone a good day. Thank you.